So can you go a little bit into the different types of hallucinations that are in the pit?
Yeah, well, so there's what I would consider three layers of hallucination. There's probably more than that, but there's three that are people are most familiar with. The first one, and the one that's most often studied in the literature, are these kind of geometric hallucinations, sometimes called phosphenes or flicker hallucinations, which are patterns, grids, webs, spirals, fractals, kind of abstract geometric shapes. And those are called entoptic hallucinations, meaning they come from the optic nerve or the optic tract. And the way those hallucinations are formed, you can actually start to form phosphenes by just closing your eyes and pressing on your eyelids for a while. You'll start to get these blinking lights or strobing lights in your brain. And you can actually kind of see the control interrupt going on in there, the strobing, the flickering, creating this amorphic blob of light. Now, the patterns that those flickering blobs begin to form over time have to do with the spatial orientation of the retina and the visual and the columns, the neural columns in the visual cortex. So if you get flickering patterns that are like spirals or webs or round in nature, those are coming from the ring spatial networks in the eye. And if you're having geometric patterns that are more columnar or grid-like or rows of dots or rows of spots, those are coming from the visual cortex. And there's been, I wouldn't say a lot, but there's been quite a bit of research done on the spatial orientation of the visual cortex and the retina, and the way information is compressed from rings in the retina into columns in the visual cortex, and how when you interrupt that communication from the retina to the visual cortex, depending on where that interruption happens, you'll get different types of geometric hallucinations, from spirals to grids and stuff like that. And there's mathematical representations for how interruptions in the visual cortex produce different types of grids, and how interruptions in the retina produce different kinds of spirals and rings and like blooming flowers and stuff like that. And each one can do this kind of checkerboarding thing, where you get these sort of checkerboard, or swirling checkerboard, or pinwheel checkerboard kind of results. And that is all generated between the eye and the visual cortex. And then that's the first layer of hallucination, those geometric hallucinations.
Okay, and I guess that's why they kind of, it's pretty easy to make fractal type art because it's pretty much the exact same thing, just done through a computer mathematics.
Yeah, so it's funny. A lot of the mathematics that describe how loss of contrast in the columns of the visual cortex, like the pixel rendering columns and the line rendering columns of the visual cortex, if you lose a little bit of contrast rendering in these columns, depending on what direction it leaks into, the contrast leaks, you get a different kind of geometric hallucination, like a honeycomb or a grid or a checkerboard, depending on the way these leak. And the math that describes this process is very much like a screensaver or a Photoshop filter that applies a progressive blur over time until all you're left with is kind of like this Gaussian pattern or this checkerboard pattern. It's really interesting when you start to think about it, that just like simple changes in the way that our brain renders line or renders contrast between lines and pixels will create these massive grids and hallucinatory geometric patterns.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's awesome.
So, and that's how if you put on like a mind machine or strobe light machines,
yeah.
Those are the kind of hallucinations you're going to be producing, depending on what the range of strobing you have is.
Right.
I've found that a lower frequency strobing, like from like 4 to 10 hertz, produces more radial patterns, which I think is are affecting the retina. Huh. And the higher the frequency you go, you start to get into more columns and grids and checkerboard. So that's kind of stimulating the visual cortex more. So you can play with mind machines at different frequencies and kind of figure out which neural communication process you're hacking into with that frequency. Based kind of hallucination that it produces. Yeah, so this is the kind of level of depth that Pitt gets into. And I think when most people hear it for the first time, they go, I didn't even really imagine that that was possible. That's really what's going on. I mean, this is all testable. You can play with this stuff. You can play with your own home and try it out. And yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of people that, read scientific information, they kind of can't really relate to it most of the time. So they consider it as, well, he doesn't know kind of thing, because of that. But I think everybody definitely can relate to what you're talking about with the visuals and seeing those type of things.
Yeah, so the second layer we kind of already talked about, the eidetic hallucinations or the dreamlike hallucinations.
Okay.
When you go beyond the geometric grids and you get more into these photorealistic dream images, that's when you're actually tweaking that gate between 5-HT and acetylcholine. And usually in the progression of hallucination, drugs start with these kind of geometric grids and overlays. And then the more the drug effect progresses and the more the interrupt takes over, the more these dream images come to the fore, and that's the second layer of hallucination. And that's called eidetic, or dreamlike, or photorealistic, or concrete hallucination.
I see.
Yeah. We've already covered that pretty much, but that's kind of, I think, what most people find are the most fascinating parts, is when you start getting those actual fully realized images spouting out of your brain.
So, in a way, it's like, it's your full imagination in a way. Instead of you perceiving reality as it is, you're perceiving reality as your mind kind of makes up. So it's like, it's almost like a dream, in a way.
It is your full imagination, but there's a part of it that is purely reflex, like a muscle twitching, that you don't really have any control over. Because when your brain goes to match patterns in these fields of abstract noise that are coming in, it's going to reach for the first thing you can find. It's going to reach for a face. It's going to reach for an animal. It's going to reach for a vine. It's going to be looking for a pattern that it can recognize. Mm-hmm. When it latches onto a pattern in the noise, it fills in the blank and says, aha, I found a face in the noise. And suddenly, faces that you've never seen before, people you've never met, are coming out of your hallucination.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And people go, oh my God, I knew something weird was going on because suddenly I was seeing faces of people I had never met.
Yeah.
And, that's just your brain trying, the facial recognition parts of our brain are the most robust pattern matching of any part of our brain. So, of course, the first thing that we're going to start to see in noise is little faces.
Mm-hmm.
Faces and shapes of bodies, shapes of things that our brain is really, really wired to identify. And that goes with predators, too, like jaguars and snakes and spiders and ants and all of the other classic things that are hallucinated in a psychedelic trip.
Interesting. So with your theory, my question, I guess, that just came up in my mind is when you move, you kind of said that when you move and you're in that deep state, you kind of reset it, reset your brain to come back to, reality and have some of that input. And then you close your eyes. Why do some people go back to where they left off, kind of, like it continues on? Or sometimes they, I know with one of our guests, he talked about his Salvia experiences. He continued to go back to the same place that he was before, even though he wasn't trying to do that. You know what I mean?
So every time he smoked salvia, it's like the dream picked up exactly where it left off last time? Well, that's That's kind of unusual. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds awesome. I don't know if that's ever happened. I have recurring dreams in my sleep that sometimes pick up a little bit where a previous dream had left off.
Exactly.
But I have a lot of other dreams in between. It's not like that's all that happens. So I haven't really heard that one before, but that would be really interesting if every time you take a drug, you wake up in the same room with the same people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, that would definitely be a little bit more harder to explain. Maybe he's just got a really robust pause button. In his dreaming mind that can just pick up right where it left off.
Well, some people, I mean, and I can see how it applies to your theory still. Not saying anything is wrong with your theory. It sounds pretty, pretty realistic.
Yeah, you know, and one thing I say is that Pitt doesn't really attempt to describe everything about psychedelics.
Right.
It's really just going after this one piece of perception and hallucination. And although it talks mostly about visual hallucination, it also applies to tactile hallucination, like tingling and senses of your body expanding and whatever, as well as sound hallucinations and other types of things. But yeah, that's really my bailiwick is just kind of getting into the hacking of the perceptual systems.
Yeah.
There's a lot of other stuff that goes on with psychedelics, like emotional stuff and memory stuff and tricks people do with their trips that are particular to their style. This theory doesn't really get to that layer. It's really just mostly focusing on this control interrupt method and the tweaking of neural processes and how different drugs do that differently.
Not dying your theory down or anything, but most of these things I've actually heard through dream research and things like that, because I mean I've read Alan Hobson's book and a lot of it's in there, so I mean it's not really anything new. It's just put in a different perspective of
the thing that's new that I've added in Pitt is really kind of defining this control interrupt model and interference in terms of packets or an interrupt frequency, and this idea of frame layering. There's a frame layering model in there that talks about how when hallucination gets to a certain point, frames, visual memory frames, start to stack up on each other and create, you know, trails and echoes and all of these weird sort of perceptual effects that have to do with kind of delay and feedback. And the frame layering method, or the frame layering model, is also the other thing that's new in Pitt. And everything else is kind of stuff that I've found from other places like Hobson or Dave Nichols and kind of put it all together in this, like I said, like a unified theory of hallucination or this umbrella theory.
Okay. So in your Pitt theory, you go into a lot of talk about shamanism and kind of mystic different beliefs and things like that. Can you tell us, you know, a little bit more of why you went into that and how your Pitt theory applies to that?
So the second part of psychedelic information theory is what I call shamanism in the age of reason. And the underlying assumption of shamanism in the age of reason, or physical shamanism, is that all traditional shamanic techniques, such as singing, dancing, chanting, drumming, rhythmic motion, they are all there to help drive and amplify this control interrupt frequency of each drug, so that the shaman can either push somebody deeper into this dead space where they're kind of hanging in a trance state, or pull them out of this dead space where they can kind of reflect and have a little more self-awareness of what's going on, and use methods of entrainment, ritual entrainment, which is anything rhythmic, any kind of rhythmic stimulus that they can apply to, once the person has taken the drug and their brain becomes sort of malleable in these frequency ranges, the shaman can then lock into the range that they want to move the person into, which usually comes intuitively. They can feel the drug moving in their system, and they can kind of lock onto the frequency that the drug is working on. Okay. Then they amplify that through their song, their ikaro, or their drumming. or whatever their method is, whatever their rhythmic entrainment method is. And so, really, I've kind of tried to break down all of the traditional tropes and methodologies and techniques of traditional shamanism and kind of explain them in a way that's more physical. Like there's a more real, there's a harmonic theory there about how different kinds of rhythmic drivers can mold the psychedelic state through different layers.
Okay. That makes sense.
So that's the overview. And I go into that a little bit, talking about entrainment and hypnosis and getting a little bit into the spirit realms and things that are a little bit harder to define. But you'll notice that when you get into that area of the book, there's there's far less references there than there are anywhere else, because this is pretty new territory that I'm getting into. Basically, what I'm saying is that if you can describe psychedelic action in terms of this control interrupt frequency, shamanism, therefore, can be described by the way a shaman messes with that interrupt frequency by using his own interrupt frequency layered over it. So he can amplify that frequency or diminish that frequency.
I see.
Based on how he runs the ritual, the speed and the tempo and those kind of things.
That totally makes sense. So you're not necessarily saying that it's all mumbo-jumbo kind of things. It's just that they're able to help their people, or they can, you know, hurt people based on how they perform their ceremonies and how the brain interprets that information, I guess.
Yeah, so there is a layer of mumbo-jumbo over it. But I think the core techniques are sound. They have sound physical theory for why people do things. So, like, there's things like before a shamanic ceremony starts, you have to form the circle, right? And you create the circle and you hold the sacred space.
Okay.
And I think, to me, what the shaman is doing when he forms the circle and he creates a ground state in the sacred space is he's creating, and this is getting a little into the math parts, he's creating a thermodynamic space that's buffered from outside interference. And when people lock together into this ring, they create a circuit between them that the shaman controls. He becomes the control unit of the circuit. And he can control the circuit by how much medicine is applied to each individual and how he runs them through their entrainment ritual.
Okay.
And he can guide them in and out of layers of deepness and alertness by holding that circuit together. But once energy starts to leak out of the circuit, the ceremony starts to fall apart. So holding that ring together and holding that sacred space, setting a shamanic helper at each corner of the room or each center side of the ring is a way of maintaining the structural or integrity of the circuit so entropy doesn't leak the energy out of the circuit. And this is a mathematical way of explaining, you know, some of the most hardcore elements of shamanic ritual that no shaman wants to break. They always want to hold space. They always want to keep the circuit clean. They can use whatever mumbo-jumbo they want to describe why they're doing that. But to me, it seems the reason they're doing that is that it's to fight the entropy of the system and keep control over the way the information is flowing.
Makes sense. We'll go into a couple questions here that people asked online. One of our guests online asked if his name's Zarko, if any practical or applied use this model has.
So in terms of therapy? Or,
I guess therapy.
Yes, so basically, the applied use of psychedelics has already been established through shamanism and through clinical therapy. Okay? My theory does not need to provide the applicability to daily life.
Okay.
What it does is it describes how psychedelics are applicable. Okay, so it doesn't say that psychedelics are useful in therapy, But if psychedelics were useful in therapy, you could use Pitt to describe how they are useful.
Hmm.
And what Pitt says is that if you're using it in therapy, basically what you're trying to do is change belief and behavior.
Hmm.
And the way you change belief and behavior is by interrupting a person's self-referential control loop, inserting a new program or identity belief system, and then bringing them back online. And if you use a psychedelic, you promote new neural growth, new neural generation, and new synaptic strengthening between new beliefs. So if you're talking about using psychedelics in therapy, Pitt describes how to, you know, the method by which you would do that. And that includes sort of identity tinkering and then follow-up programming to ensure that the new neural growth and the new synaptic connections are sticking.
Okay.
So, yeah, but you can also apply that to brainwashing.
Mm-hmm.
You can apply that to, you know, different modalities. If all you want to do is make somebody have a really excellent, good time, that's necessarily not therapeutic, but is like, you know, booty shaking and awesome,
yeah.
Then a DJ could use Pitt to push people into extended realms of bliss, right? So he could use the fundamentals of the theory to program a shamanic trip or a shamanic ritual that would produce the desired result.
Interesting.
So that's how it's applicable. Now, shamans already do that. They already program ritual. They already produce desired outcomes because they've done testing and experimentation.
Hmm.
And they've built their own routines. What I'm saying is Pitt can be applied to any one of those routines to describe what they're doing. From a DJ to a shaman to a cult leader to somebody who's doing clinical therapy in their doctor's office, they're all using the same kind of method.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Another one of our followers, Ralu, he asked a question about if this can be used to determine. Hold on a sec. Sorry, I'm gonna edit that again. I guess that brings up the question of like, why is it that you have such a drive and a want to understand these things?
I guess it comes first from my own fascination with illusion and fooling the brain, and second, it comes from my desire to delve into something mysterious and strange about the universe, and you know, try to find if there's something more. I think that's a drive for a lot of people, and third. I kind of grew tired of all of the psychedelic celebrity culture where all of this, you know, content, you know, somebody has a weird psychedelic trip and they write about it or they talk about it, and suddenly that content becomes some kind of spiritual canon about what psychedelics are for or, you know, what the real use of psychedelics is or what the proper use of psychedelics is. And you know, I just kind of got wary of people, you know, kind of perverting or subverting the psychedelic paradigm for these really kind of grandiose and self-serving notions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have any grandiose or self-serving notions. I just want to figure out how it works.
Yeah.
And I think the more people focus on grandiose notions, the farther they're getting away from talking about psychedelics and the more they're talking about their own personal BS.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you start focusing on how it actually works, then you're getting back to talking about psychedelics. You know, when you go into these grandiose notions, you're talking about the information that psychedelics generate. Mm-hmm. You're not actually talking about the process. So I wanted to return the discussion back to the process because I got sick of all of these, you know, sad content, you know, fetishes about elves or, you know, spirits or whatever.
Right,
whatever.
Exactly.
You know, it can be anything. But they come and go, and people get really, really invested in them. And in a way, I feel that that's kind of missing the bigger picture.
Right, exactly.
You can believe whatever you want to believe, but if you're just you're not sure what's going on, then, then how are you going to form a good belief? I mean, it's...
Yeah, exactly.
So...
Yeah, that totally makes sense. It sounds like there's kind of two different communities going on. There's the community that where you kind of used to belong to, which is the scientific side, where it's pretty much been removed from any type of academics based on what happened in the 60s. And then there's all the people that do things anyways and write about their experiences. So it's seems like maybe it's a little hard for you to fit in.
Well, yeah, I kind of straddle the line because I came into psychedelics and I didn't really have any spiritual preconceptions about what they were, you know, and I didn't really have any spiritual or religious trips until I was kind of introduced to that paradigm. Hmm. And then when I got into that paradigm and got further into the whole, you know, shamanic plant spirit, guy in mind, alien, whatever, the more I realized that it was just, you know, it was, I don't want to use the word hokum too lightly, but there was just a lot of layers of storytelling going on over something that wasn't really, that, you know, my experience never really fit into any of those stories. You know, they sort of did, but they were always weirder or different, or you know, they it wasn't always as cut and dried as that. So I don't know. I've forgotten what the question was now.
Yeah, it wasn't really. It was kind of like a statement of asking you, like, kind of where you fit into this.
Oh, right. So let me go back to that. So I started off being very fascinated by the spiritual side of it, but then kind of got burned out on that and became more interested in the science side of it. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that the people who didn't know what they were talking about and were producing all of these spiritual theories were getting all of the press and the celebrity and the attention and all the book deals. Mm-hmm. And the guys that were, like, in the lab doing the research or doing the legitimate research, or the guys who were, like, in their basements or apartments doing the underground illegitimate research,
right,
like me, we were just, like, nobody cared what we were doing.
Yeah.
You know, nobody cared about how hippocampal stimulation causes eidetic imagery.
Right.
Just like gibberish to those people, so I can understand where people kind of disregard the science because it's not fun.
Right.
I mean, it's not fun and exciting like a little story that you can tell about elves and hyperdimensional.
Exactly.
I mean, it's boring, and it's, you know, there's math and anatomy involved, and it's like
Yeah.
But to me, that's it's the more interesting side. I kind of went through the other side and came back to, oh yeah, well, it's really the brain that's the fascinating thing, not these elves and spirits.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like we need more people like you, I guess, that are in the main public to talk about these things. Like you were talking to me about how it's hard for you to even publish your book, which is amazing to me. Can you go into a little bit more of the resistance
you've had? I was looking around for publishers, and probably the biggest publisher is Inner Traditions Park Street Press, and I submitted it there a couple times and got kind of tepid responses, which said, well, we're not really sure if this is going to be what our readers want.
Yeah.
Can you maybe send us something more along the lines of this? Is this something that's not so scientific? And at one point there was a little publishing division of Oxford University Press that was interested in it, but they said it was a little too psychedelic-y and a little too shaman-y for them, even though, and to be honest, I'm a little sloppy. I mean, it's not a complete academic piece of work. There is a little bit of speculative stuff in there, and it does try to mash a lot of things together under one theory. So it's not really a typical textbook, but it's not a typical My Psychedelic Adventure book either. you know. So, after, I don't know, maybe a year of kind of looking around half-heartedly for someone who would maybe be interested in it, I just decided to publish it, self-publish it, because it's just as easy to do it that way. I mean, I know my market is pretty small to begin with, so no publisher is going to say, yeah, well, a book that's going to sell maybe 5,000 copies over a period of 5 years, that's our big number one seller that we're going to sign next.
Yeah, totally.
I have a little audience that I've built over the year, and I know there's a lot of people out there who are interested in psychedelics, maybe not as deep as this book goes, but one day they may be, and they'll come back to it and go, oh, yeah, now I see what he's saying. So I wrote it to be valid for the next 50 years. I mean, I wrote it to be a theory that people can keep coming back to over and over and over and over again, and it's not going to go out of style, and it's not going to go out of fad, because it really does focus on the root physiological aspects. Mm-hmm. And from the response I've gotten from people in the neuroscience community, and especially people who study perception, they're pretty fascinated with it.
They
think that there's something there. And especially the fact that I'm starting to describe consciousness and perception in terms of the speed and the fidelity of speed processing, that's something that's a little new. I mean, a lot of the going trend was talking about consciousness in terms of richness of neural firing or neural spiking. And I'm kind of adding this other element to it that's saying, no, it's not all about the richness, it's about the speed. The speed and the fidelity of the process. And when you look at the speed and the fidelity of the process of consciousness, you realize how easy it is to tweak and alter that.
Yeah, it's definitely...
by altering the speed and the fidelity.
It's definitely an interesting concept, like, to understand that you can almost do just as much, you know, with smaller doses, things like that, just in a different way. Like, sound can do the same, almost the same effect, it's just in a different way. And it's just mind-blowing, really, to hear it in such a way that you put it. So I'm going to look much more into it and keep going and read it over again, and I think I'll understand a lot better this time.
Yeah, it's so hard to figure out how to explain things. I wrote it for somebody who has, like, a scientific background, and, you know, to me, when I first came into psychedelics... or when I first started studying the science, the brain science, I was reading peer-reviewed scientific papers from journals like Neuroscience or, you know, Psychedelic Pharmacology, and trying to, you know, it was an uphill battle for me. I spent a lot of years struggling to learn and just get up to speed on the different ideas that were out there, and it didn't come easy for me. It didn't come overnight. It took... I mean, I would say a good 6 years of writing and researching on a part-time basis to come to the point where I said, gosh, I really understand this now. And up until that point, I made a lot of mistakes, and I had a lot of notions that I thought were right but that weren't quite correct, and... And the reason that I know I'm onto a good theory is that every time a new piece of research comes out, it seems to corroborate what I'm saying. So I think that's a good sign. And even if I'm not necessarily famous for what I'm doing, I think that a lot of people will find it very useful.
Definitely.
If they really want to put in the work to figure it all out.
So we should have gone into this a little earlier, but do you have a background in... like psychology or anything like that? Because a lot of your work seems like it's coming from neuroscience and things like that. So
my background is in my degree was in creative writing.
Okay.
I was a psychology major for a little bit, but I have to say 2 years into psychology undergraduate work, I thought, this is a lot of BS.
Yeah.
And I got out of it. I was also studying philosophy, and I thought that was a lot of BS too. So I went into professional writing, a creative writing program, where I could just focus on writing and, you know, getting good at explaining my thoughts to people. Around the time I graduated from college, that's when my interest in psychedelics began. And I'm also a programmer. I'm a computer programmer. So a lot of the models that I put together in the beginning were based around treating consciousness as like a piece of software that's running, you know, with different parallel threads and different subprocesses. And there is still some of that. And when I talk about the book explaining what is consciousness, that's a very cybernetic theory, which is like a self-regulating set of subsystems that pass information from one to the next. So that's kind of where the programming part of it fits in. And I never really had much use for psychological models because they always seemed too abstract to me. Mm-hmm. Like, where is the ego?
Like it's located in some spot.
Yeah, they create these sort of abstract language models and try to categorize people based on these sort of abstractions of behavior. And it never really kind of rung true to me. It was almost like, you know, poking around in the dark with a stick trying to figure out what you're dealing with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess in every way science is kind of like that. It's poking around with a stick and trying to figure out, you know,
in the dark.
Most of the time in the dark and not knowing exactly what's going on. But it sounds like your poking your stick helped, seems to be hitting something. And, you know, just because you have a degree in creative writing doesn't mean that you're anywhere far from hitting on neuroscience and psychology. It seems to me, from what my experience in psychology is, your stuff's right on and...
Well, what I learned was that if you're a writer, you can write about anything.
So true.
And all you have to do is study and do your homework. And, I spent, like I said, I spent years studying neuroscience and anatomy and realizing that I had a big deficit there. And I still have a big math deficit. There's a lot of stuff in neural computation publishing that I just can't understand. And, I'm working on it. I'm still working on it, and I self-teach myself pretty much everything, because the internet is a great resource.
Yeah, definitely.
And a lot of the things that were originally gibberish to me or sounded like, oh my god, I'll never understand that, are now like, oh yeah, I get that now. So,
all right.
So do your homework, kids.
Yeah, definitely.
Study math.
I started off in psychology, and I'm reading about anthropology right now, so
I had an anthropology minor, so.
Oh, nice.
I went through all of the liberal arts at some point.
Awesome. Well, is there any place that people can get your PIT?
They can go to psychedelicinformationtheory.com.
Okay.
And it's available online. You can download a PDF or read chapters online, or there's a link to Amazon where you can buy the text. And
is it actually free on your website, or
you can get the download for free. It's freely available. Some people know that, some people don't. I don't have any problem with people downloading it for free. I considered it a piece of scientific publishing, so I think the information should be in the public domain, and it should be accessible to people who want to find it, and. That's why I made it available for free. Getting it in hard copy is easier for a lot of people because they can sit in the tub and read it or whatever.
Exactly.
But now with Kindles and everything, it should be. There's no excuse.
Yeah, you should be able to download for free now, definitely. Also, what are some of the other projects that you're involved in right now?
We had a drug blog, the former editors of Trip magazine that I used to publish, and I got together and did a web blog called DoseNation.com, but we put that on hiatus about six or eight months ago, because we were all involved in other projects and didn't really have the time to do the daily blog. I'm working on finishing up a couple other books right now, and that's kind of taking up most of my time. I always have a lot of projects on the back burner, mostly programming projects.
Oh, neat.
I have, my day job is as a technology consultant, and I do a lot of programming and networking consulting for clients.
And
that takes up more of my time than I like than I would like it to. But when I have free time, I am trying to publish more material. So,
oh great,
that's the shorter and longer term goals. There's to publish material and try to get a lot of the work that I've generated over the years more compiled in places where people can download or buy them.
Well, great. Well, James, thanks so much for speaking with us today, and hopefully a lot of people can learn something from this podcast and pick up the pit and look a little bit more into it and spread the word around. You know, I think that your goal is a good goal to inform people of what's going on, and information is power. It's never something to look down on. It sounds like you're helping a lot. So I appreciate
thank you,
James.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a great interview.
Thanks, James.